Cubit, hello. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's very lovely to have you with us today. Performer, theatre maker, puppet director, movement director. How do you answer the inevitable what do you do question when you meet new people?
Yes, that is a good question. It's the kind of spread betting approach to a career in theatre.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of go for the term theatre maker as a catch-all. But I suppose I just generally do a list. I mean, I started as a performer and I always couched it as performer rather than actor, because pretty soon I went into devising and making rather than here's a role, learn that sort of approach. Yeah. So it's sort of always been along that line, or that was an entry point, and then have moved into directing more, sort of movement directing first and then puppetry directing. So yeah, it's an interesting one. It often depends who I'm talking to.
Right, of course.
You know, the angle at which they're kind of coming at it. But I thought today puppetry, movement, visual language is a term I'm kind of playing with at the moment. It seems to be quite evolutionary, actually.
Yeah. That's an interesting term, visual language. It's very true that, you know, the work we do, the spoken word is part of it, but so much more is about the visual language, where and how people's bodies are presented in the space.
Yeah, definitely. And I think just the type of work that has been quite prevalent in the last 10 years certainly has been with a focus on the sort of what world are we in? What's the making language of this? Like, what's the sort of level of play and where are we? And that often seems to be to do with the movement language, or there's puppetry in it. You know, so I suppose like how metaphorical or poetic or what it becomes, and the other things that are in there apart from the text, and finding a world in which they can all sit happily together and make sense. And it doesn't feel like a hodgepodge. It feels like a cohesive piece.
Yeah. So how did it begin? How did you get into theatre and performing initially?
I suppose through the well-trodden route of youth theatres and national youth theatres and all of that. I grew up in Stratford-upon-Avon, which may have, I don't know, informed me.
Were your family kind of active RSC theatre goers? And
we saw lots. We were always standing at the back, got £5 tickets. I remember standing through, it was a King Lear, it was about 5 hours long when I was probably 8 or something, you know. And yet
you're still a theatre maker.
The things I remember the most, they used to do these dark seasons when visiting shows used to come in, and they were not Shakespeare, controversially. And those were probably the ones that really tickled my fancy. And they did an amazing festival at the other place. I can't remember what it was called, but it was like new writing and new plays. And it hit when I was sort of in the sixth form. And it was remarkable. And loads of them were kind of promenade. You know, it felt really radical at the time. And there was some incredible writing that just chimed with doing A-levels and thinking about careers. And that was pretty instrumental, I'd say. But I always danced. I danced and sort of maybe thought I was going to go into ballet and that side of it. But I also was nearly a high jumper. I've always done quite physical things.
Yeah.
And sort of being able to do physical stuff and acting was a meeting for me that made absolute sense. I was like, okay, great. I get a bit of everything.
So you did youth theatre in Stratford and then National Youth Theatre. And then did you go and study drama?
Yeah. And it was back in the day, really, when it was just like acting, you know, the big acting thing. But I went to university first in Hull, and then I went to drama school at Webber Douglas. And actually Hull Uni was another moment of just real freedom, loads of writing, loads of workshop time. It gave the whole department over to the students. And it was very kind of cohesive model that models what it is actually like, you know.
What was the course in Hull?
It was called drama.
It was drama, okay.
Yeah, but it was very theoretical as well. But you also had the run of the department and all of the facilities and programs, like studio weeks and writing weeks. And it was very, very student-led.
Yeah, so you got a huge amount of freedom to do your own thing and learn yourselves with each other.
Yeah. So that was an incredible training ground, actually. And loads of people are doing really exciting things from that time. You bump across people from Hull all the time. It's a funny little reoccurring place.
Where did you first encounter puppetry? Where did that start?
One of my first jobs was with Theatre Rights, who are an amazing, they make amazing puppets and focus work for early years, audiences. And that came through, I was working with a company called Fevered Sleep, and they were doing a co-direction with them. And I came in as a physical theatre performer, and then on the job learned puppetry It was an amazing introduction because Sue, who's the artistic director, is very purist about objects and object theatre and how objects can be manipulated into life. So rather than sort of puppets, we were in a hospital in Croydon that was sort of taken over for a bit. It was all object stuff, object manipulation. And it was really joyous and really fun and completely made sense with me with the sort of physical approach to storytelling that I'd got into after drama school.
Mm.
And so that was the entry point really through Sue. And then my second job was War Horse.
That was your second job. Okay.
My second big job. I'd spent a long time with Stephen Slee previous to that, doing a lot of physical work. And I'd come to them through Battersea Art Centre. So Battersea Art Centre were another real kind of launch pad where I met Gek and did some physical stuff with them, went into working with Stephen Slee and devising where they work with all kind of departments at the beginning of a process. Mm. I just thought that was the absolute best and made the most sense to me. And then it did evolve from there, I suppose.
Should we talk a bit about puppets since we've mentioned them? For you, what's the appeal of a puppet as a storytelling device?
It's a good question. There's a practicality that I really love, whereby it's all about doing. It's all about doing a thing. So you have to commit in a way that, I don't know, with text, I find it hard to commit. I think actors are really brilliant at doing exactly that. But with the practical level of having a thing in your hand that you have to move and commit to the movements, there's something that is really immediate about it and demands like a level of attention and commitment from an actor that you can't really drop below. And if you do, you just can't read them and they just stop working. So there's something quite black and white about them that I find really satisfying and really satisfying to watch. You don't even have to be that good at puppeteering, but as long as you really believe it, that comes across. And there's something just really joyous and pure about that for me, and pretty simple, but at the same time, there's an ambiguity and a sort of ephemeralness, which I also like, being in that ambiguity where the audience working quite hard and there's more options of reading what's being put on stage than maybe I've sometimes experienced some text.
Whatever emotion or whatever expression you're trying to convey, you have to distill the human version down to something quite simple for it to work. Is that right?
Well, not necessarily simple, but a specific thing.
Yeah, okay. That's a much better word. I knew even as I said simple, it wasn't quite the right word. Yeah.
Yeah. No, specific, I think, is the thing. Because if you're not sure what you're playing, that's what they'll read. They'll read uncertainty and they'll read it really well. So you have to make choices and you have to make them really fast and really commit to them. Even if you're not sure about them, you still have to commit to them.
In my mind, there's an obvious reason to use puppets to present animals and supernatural characters because, you know, you can. There's no limit, really, is there? But I've never been able to quite put my finger on what it is about puppets in human form, because it's something quite strange and particular that somehow actual performers don't bring to the stage. Does a puppet of a human form, are they able to express something that a real person can't? Or is it to do with the way that the audience engages? Because I'm thinking, you know, puppets are used a lot in therapy with younger children, for example.
Yeah. There is definitely something for me about the kind of work that takes place in making them come to life or animating a puppet, that you're somehow aware of the work being done and the effort that takes.
Yeah.
However kind of, you know, you might be trying to disguise that effort, but I think there's like a degree of awareness of that and an appreciation of that, which, you know, like watching a painter paint or seeing brushstrokes, it's along those lines, or seeing kind of dancers really breathing. There's something that permanently reminds you that work is being done that I really appreciate, because it's some, you know, with live performance, that is what's amazing, watching the people turn up and do their work. And that permanent reminder, I think, is really great. There's also Basil and Adrian from Handspring talk about like the effort of living, just that we all, you know, the effort of everyday lives is exhausting in when you're just living your own life. It's kind of keeping it all going and, you know, that sort of thing, striving that we all do. And it's joyful and all the other stuff that it is. But there's something representational of that as well, which I think is quite interesting, that you get to watch a bit of the striving that you think, yeah, cool, yeah, I know that.
Yeah. And perhaps also, is it to do with the sort of the universal nature of an expression of emotion we recognize? And there's something very pleasurable about watching a representation of that in a puppet form, so for some reason. Even just the smallest movement can sometimes be enough. And that's somehow very pleasing to an audience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the stuff that I really love. And it's what I love about movement or dance or any of this kind of language where you're in something that's a bit more kind of kinesthetic, or you're reading it on a level that isn't necessarily your literal brain, perhaps.
Mm.
And we're just so good at reading people. We do it so fast. We do it all the time. Like, we have this muscle that we are constantly using. And I think when you get to use it in a bit more of a declared way, it's really satisfying. Yeah. Like you say, you get all these little hits. For me, it's like an amazing music score, you know, where you get the sort of completions of little bits of music and it makes you feel really, really great. It's a lot of those little hits.
So what makes a successful puppet?
I work really closely with the puppet makers a lot. And there seems to be, there's a sweet spot, it feels like, between something that gives you enough, can dictate enough so that you go, oh yeah, that's a leg swing that works in that way and it doesn't swing backwards. So, you know, you don't get a leg that does something that a leg doesn't do if it's a human, say. But also is figurative enough to leave gaps for your imagination. And then that's where the audience is working. And that's when this sort of cloud of play opens up where you're in expressive movement territory.
Mm.
Which feels super rich. So it's an amalgamation of just enough and then leaving a gap. But there's something about the organicness for me as well, about how like a human can then beat this object. And, you know, there's enough sort of push and pull within it that they can join it. Like, some people make puppets out of metal. I've worked with a brilliant maker called Max Pomfries, and we do a couple of shows together, and his puppets are lots of mechanisms and metal frameworks. They're very huge scale, very, very big, I should say. That's what they have, this like superstructure. And that's very different from, say, the Warhorse ones, that they're sort of bamboo, you know, with a bit of give in it, even though it's wood, there's a bit of flex. So long as a human can meet the object and they can sort of fuse in some way. Mm. That's what I enjoy spending the first few weeks doing, is going, okay, what is this thing? What does it want to do? And how does it want to move? And what does it do well? And that isn't necessarily what the character of the thing does. That's the elemental materials and joints. And that's more sort of the physics of the object.
Well, presumably the sort of way that it moves as well goes a long way to inform what the character becomes.
Yeah.
It can go both ways, right? Because if you know you're making a character that's supposed to be villainous, then you might build it a certain way, but you might discover that a puppet also brings something else unexpected that then adds another strand of character. You have to get to know them.
Yeah. Yeah, you totally do. And they might not do what they are supposed to do at all. There's a big, large-scale puppetry show called Dinosaur World that we do. They've been on an evolution, these puppets, but one of them was a huge Triceratops. And his first incarnation, he didn't particularly go very fast. He was pretty heavy because he was sort of built for someone to ride him. And then we realized that probably wasn't great to put a kid on top of, you know, sort of 4-meter-high Triceratops. We ditched that idea, but he was still built to carry loads of weight. So he was a hefty old guy. And we got to do his scene, and I was just like, you know, this guy, his main character trait is that he can't do anything. They can't really get on fast enough, and he can't really turn around. It takes ages, and he has to do the 3-point turn. And that became his whole scene, and that became his whole character. And he's super endearing now because that's his shtick.
So that's his role. That's what he does. That's who he is. That's amazing.
There's always an element of that. And it's fun to try, you know, retrofit writing. And there is a lot of rewriting and a lot of rediscovery in the room. And also the puppeteers you have, because they all have very different qualities as well, that bring something out. And you go, oh, yeah, maybe a bit of that's actually a nice flavour.
I just wanted to pick up on one other thing you said, which was filling the gaps. That seems to be an important part of why puppets are interesting, because they demand the audience to somehow fill the gaps. And in a case of a puppet like Joey, there's a lot of gaps because it's essentially a skeletal creature, right? You can see right the way through it. there's a sort of sense that the audience has to bring something to complete the image.
Yeah, totally. And they have to do that for the whole time they're sat down, which is a long time. And I've done sort of dance shows with companies whereby they've like made people's eyes look in certain directions, you know, to exercise eyeballs. And, you know, like that level of kind of physical engagement from an audience from the get-go, it does put them in a different state of mind. Like they're kind of ready. And with Warhorse, there's a whole kind of training section to the show whereby they teach the audience how to read the puppets. Because back then, it wasn't a kind of known quantity. So Baby Joey's whole deal, really, he was this sort of training guy.
Right.
And first thing he did was just one flick of his ear. That's it. And then maybe a breath, actually, first in his rib cage, and then an ear flick, and then a tail flick, like one thing at a time. And the ear flick was tiny.
In the Olivier.
Yeah, to 1,000 people for them to read it. And nothing else. And you're teaching them, like, going to ask you to read things this small.
Mm.
And then going to ask you to read breath, which is this small.
Yeah.
Mm. And you're building it like that so that then by the time the big horse crashes on in, not only does he feel bigger because you've been watching very infinitesimal movement for ages, you're really attuned. So suddenly you get this high definition, ton of movement and sound.
Mm.
Real dynamic with varying wallop crash.
And I guess part of that as well is not just the movement of the foal's ear, it's about the focus of everybody else on stage to make sure that the energy of the room is directed towards watching the foal's ear move.
Yeah, absolutely. And having the confidence, I suppose, to go, this is all we're asking someone to watch.
I think one of the interesting things about Warhorse, of course, is you're very aware of the puppeteers as well as the puppets on stage. And is that the case for a lot of the puppets you work with these days, that the performers, the puppeteers, are very much with their bodies portraying part of the character?
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, and is that a conversation you have early on about whether the puppeteers are visible to the audience or not, and how you justify them and use them on stage and their place in the narrative?
I haven't really done anything when they're not declared. It's all been very much present, very much there and contributing to the image. And there's degrees to which, you know, how much they are really declaring that they're there. But there's an interesting thing which we always hit against. And this sits within the question of like the world of a play, which is always like, who are the puppeteers and how do you get them on stage? If it isn't a show like Warhorse, where you're just saying, okay, these are animals and just come with us, believe that, don't pay much attention to these humans, then there's always a moment where you're like, who are these guys who have strolled on? You know, are they the townsfolk or are they the metaverse or are they impending doom? Or is it, you know, what we're doing with them?
Mm.
It's a really big question. It can be really simple what your answer is, but you feel that you have to have an answer to that. And then once you've got dug into that, it opens up what world of storytelling are we in? And
right.
You know, and how does that relate to the content or what we're talking about in the play? And can it, in fact, sort of bolster it? Or, you know, and it is really interesting because it changes on every project. I've been doing a lot of that recently and people going, you know, in this modern world where we've got all this technology and all this AI and all of these amazing things we can do in the theatre.
Yeah.
And can you justify people coming on and moving chairs about? Do we want to see that? And if we don't, how do we get the people on?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, transitions and scene changes and just how do you get this chair from here to here? Can someone just pick it up? Does that make sense? Who is the person picking up the chair? Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, but why not make it more than that? The kind of oceans at the end of the lane approach of showing their cards a bit on how they did the scene changes. And it's just a great extra element to it.
Mm-hmm. Do you normally start rehearsals of a new production with a fully built puppet? Does that normally develop before rehearsals start? Is there sort of a workshop beforehand or does it evolve during the process? How do you go from, hey, we need a puppet to tell this part of the story to actually creating that puppet?
Usually, hopefully, there will have been a series of R&Ds and a puppet heavy R&D whereby you kind of test the language of the you know, where you even are in the world of puppetry. Like, is it a thing that floats? Does it have legs? Has it got, you know, and you've done all of that work beforehand. So by the time you turn up to rehearsals, you've got a prototype. Then during the rehearsals, there's room to tweak and go, it's all more about like technically how you use it, can I have a handle here, all that kind of stuff. But then I suppose we've done things where you're going, okay, we sort of need this, we need that, and sort of people furiously making things, you know, in the dock.
Yeah. So ideally you have a kind of army of makers just standing by to evolve things.
Yeah.
And does the set designer have an overall view, or the set of costume designer, I suppose, have an overall view of what the puppets look like to fit into the world of the show?
I'm not a puppet designer. Puppet designer is a specific role.
Yeah.
We have had interesting conversations in the past about this in terms of going, oh, can the set designer design the look of it? And can you just get somebody to make the internal parts? And I was like, well, it doesn't really work like that, because they're making a character. That's a character that's got to move in a particular way to express a particular thing that's relevant to the text and the narrative. Mm. So, you know, puppet designers writers and character makers and designers
and casting directors, I guess.
Yeah. And you know, they've got their eyes on the performing of it as well, so it's a huge part of it. They're across everything, really. And the more conversations you can have, and the more you can be in development and early R&D, where you're just going, actually, is it like this? Is it made out of baskets? Is it made out of this? Is it this scale? And it's all pretty fast and loose. That's all really invaluable. But the more you can join that up with the other departments, absolutely, the better.
But what about sound and voices or music or whatever? Do you develop sounds for the puppets as well?
I mean, for the actors to have the sound and the voice is the ideal, because then they're going off their rhythms and their timing, and they're using all of their acting skills, and it's fully embodied. I mean, puppeteers would always want to do it themselves, and I do feel for them, because they're all really wonderful actors in my experience. Yeah. There's no difference other than they're doing it through a thing outside of themselves. You know, it's not a different skill set, but often it can sort of, can get moved around.
It's a nice segue into the next question, actually, because you describe yourself as a puppet director as well as a movement director. And I suppose when I was thinking about it, I realized that the two go hand in hand, because puppetry is all about movement, sometimes on a small scale, sometimes on an enormous scale. And I'm interested to know what the dynamic is like when directing puppeteers, and the focus is all on the character, not the human. And you are, after all, directing humans, but everybody looked at the puppet, which suggests that the human takes a bit of a back seat. Is that like being backstage but on stage, if that makes any sense at all?
Yeah, it makes total sense. I've sort of heard performers go, oh, I don't really want to do that job because, you know, I'm an actor. I'm not, I want to be acting. I want to be seen. To be acting. And there is something about the like invisibility of being a puppeteer that kind of bleeds into people's perception of the work that's being done in a way that it doesn't with actors. And it's a really interesting point, because with some shows that I've worked on, well, one in particular that I'm thinking of, they were like, okay, for this bit of theatre magic, we're going to use puppetry. And that's our big coup for this show. You know, we're going to do some puppetry. But let's not tell anyone, because everyone will be wondering how we're going to do this thing. And what we're going to do is we're secretly going to use puppetry. And then, because puppetry is like a sneaky secret art form, like when you're doing it really well, you're completely not seen and it's undeclared. And that's the point, you're not looked at. It sometimes feels like there isn't anyone doing it. And then it's sometimes sort of seen as that there's nobody doing it. Mm. So in this show, the puppetry then was like the focal kind of moment in how a bit of the story was told. And then it just got sort of brushed aside, and nobody really sort of celebrated it. Or, I mean, this is obviously because it's my thing. I want it to be acknowledged. But there is something interesting in the fact that when you're doing it really well, you're not seen and your puppet is acknowledged, that can tip over into perception of how it works, in that somehow these puppets will do their thing. And you're like, no. There are real people behind there.
So you sort of become invisible not only to the audience in terms of their experience of the play, but also to everyone involved in the show, you become invisible.
It can be like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Because I guess, especially when you're making a new production, you're often contributing huge unscripted elements to the show. I guess you're part of the writing team as much as the staging team when putting a play together involving puppets.
Yeah, it's that's a really interesting one, because I mean, if it's a play with lots of puppets and you're working with a team who are sort of aware of the process of writing for puppetry or movement based work, And actually, it's about stripping away loads of text and letting the visual stuff
work. Yeah.
And it's sort of having the confidence to trust that will carry it. It will do it, but it can only do it if there's room, if you leave room and the space left. Otherwise, it absolutely can't do it. And you're doing double images all the time. And it's a bit of a wasted opportunity. And so when you get into a collaboration with writers, when you're working in that way, it's really thrilling and it can bounce back and forwards. But very often with puppet making work, making staging for puppetry, you're always in the narrative because they're standing there. If they're going to do anything, it's got to be for a reason. Because, you know, like animals, they don't just listen. Like they won't just listen to a load of text that's being spoken on stage during a scene in the way that humans do. They'll be running a whole play underneath and you're effectively like writing the beats of this whole subplay that's completely not related to the play that's been written down.
Right.
And in order to make sure everyone's doing the same thing at the same time, you're literally writing beat by beat.
I'm just curious whether if you have a script for a show that has a big element of puppetry in it, once you devise the show, does it describe the different beats the puppets are doing on the page as part of the script? How do you document it so that in 4 years' time when you come back to do that show again, there's a way of repeating it?
We've sort of evolved a way of doing it. We have like a page with a line down the middle, text on one side, and then all of the physical lines down the other side. And I sort of call them physical lines so that actors who maybe aren't so used to working with puppets know that they say their line with words, and then this puppet will say its line with movement. But yeah, it needs to say all of its line, like you can't cut
the line any more than you cut someone's words, right?
Otherwise it doesn't make sense. And so it's about that. So there's two essentials or columns running parallel.
I think actually lighting designers can identify with that notion that if you're doing your job well, you're not noticed.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Not always, yeah, but very often. But I also love the idea that the puppets sort of really take on a life of their own and become part of the company. And is it a bit weird when they're all put aside and become an inanimate object again and they're just lying on the bench?
Yeah, there's definitely something of the voodoo about them. You get it quite a lot when you run workshops. I teach a lot in drama schools, and it's often the first time people have come to any puppetry, and you make these little paper guys out of brown paper really quickly and teach them how to do it. And at the end, nobody can put them down and everyone walks out with them. And you go, I was teaching at Guildhall, and you'd like walk around and they'd be everywhere. By the end of a week, you know, we're knocking out 30 an hour. They'd be all down the canteen, like sat on all the benches. They're absolutely everywhere. Like occasionally, like in a bin with their arms sticking out of it. So you'd manage to cut their ties with that. But there is something of that. And I think it goes the other way as well. You know, like our baby Joey team was three of us girls together. We had a really specific little thing going on as a three that was really related to, obviously, of course, like any play, like relates to what you do in the play. So close. And we're all godparents to each other's kids, you know, like, because the connection is so strong.
Yeah.
And you really do go through it with each other in a way that it's very sort of singular. But yeah, it definitely feeds into your little identity as a team, for sure.
On some large puppets, those two horses as good examples, that you have several operators. So you establish a line of communication, and that must be very important, especially if there's an element of improvisation involved. Because, you know, I've seen Joey interacting with the audience, and it just, everything still seems to be completely coordinated, and yet there's no obvious set of cues there. And that's very impressive. But that obviously is something that comes with time, is it? How does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It comes with time. It's a muscle that you develop together, sort of getting into each other's brains. That was the first time I had experienced it on Warhorse. We were training with Mervyn Miller, and he created this space whereby you do a lot of training first so that you have the basics down, so you know how to walk and you know how to breathe and you can do existing really well. But then the playing of any moment, you know that you can respond to that yourself. Like as me, I could choose to play this particular moment, a response of something, with my horse foot, or I could choose to not, to leave room for someone else to do something. So you're constantly flicking the ball between the three of you, like who's going to do the focus, but you, without talking, and you do it infinitesimally quickly, and by sort of feeling each other, or you can join each other, or you can, you know, and it's incredible. It's the most thrilling version of performing I have ever done. I imagine it's what it's like if you're a really brilliant jazz musician. And that's how I describe it now that I'm directing, that you get your basics down and then you can do your jazz on the top. And that's where you want to be playing in that realm. And you have to be really good at your scales, you know, to play really well with other people. But it's that. So you're always in live moment. It's always different. If you find anything delicious, you can repeat it because, like, why not? It's really fun.
So when you're putting together a show like that, is all the detail of what the puppets are doing directed step by step, like choreography, or is it much more free with the puppeteers to work out their interpretation on each beat of the show?
Yeah, I think there's a merry dance of both, usually, because there's absolutely points when what you're doing is you're doing story beat, storytelling through movement that you need to all be on the same train so that you're moving through the story, you know, at pace or with a specific dynamic to show a specific emotion. But I suppose how you do that, there is rooms that, yeah, there's like a sweet spot of interpretation on Warhorse and with the dinosaurs, the dino show, and another show that I do, Dragons and Mythical Beasts, that I direct. There's some big sequences that I just choreographed. If there's a fight or it feels a bit more like a kind of standalone dance moment, then you're in choreography and they just sort of can whack through that. But equally, the attitude that's on top is still the performer's own.
So, yeah, there's a difference between knowing the steps and performing the steps, I suppose, even in dance. So I'm sure it applies equally to puppetry and physical movement.
Well, and actually, the more you know something, the more time opens up. I think that's where it feels like, you know, jazz drumming or something. Like, the more you know the beats, the more you can find all the tiny bits of time either side of all those beats. So you're putting in all the syncopation after that, and you can sort of do that for eternity. And that's why it's like always satisfying.
I wonder, did you ever get a response from a performer saying, I don't think Triceratops would do that?
Yeah, a lot, yeah. We had quite a funny one with a Tyrannosaurus Rex just recently. You know, they have, it's a huge puppet, I should say.
It's on your website, right? I've seen the photos of this.
Yeah, it's almost life-size Tyrannosaurus Rex, just a bit under. About 4 meters high and 6 meters long with his tail. Maybe longer, actually, maybe 7. It takes 4 people to operate. You've got big backpacks that are on their shoulders. And I mean, there's an extraordinary amount of weight over the top of the head puppeteer's head. They've got the dinosaur's head directly above them. 2 people on the legs, somebody in a position in the middle. They do lots of breathing. And in order to make it go forward, everybody has to move. Like, it's a lot of weight. It's a huge thing. With lots of puppets, you know, someone can give an impulse or an impetus and everyone then moves. But this one, if you try and move on your own, just don't go anywhere. And there was a scenario where they were running it. They were just doing a fight call and running it. Whoever was feeding the line didn't quite give them enough, you know, chutzpah when she was telling them to back up. And they were just like that. We're not backing up for that. We would not back up for that.
It must be quite a feat of endurance. I mean, you say there's a lot of weight involved in some of those puppets. It's sometimes quite uncomfortable, isn't it? Operating a puppet, especially if, you know, I guess you have your arm up in the air for a long, you know, it's just you're doing something quite unnatural for a long time in some cases.
Yeah, hugely. It's like number one part of the gig, actually, like throw yourself off center, get in a really uncomfortable position, stay there, you know, whilst just sweat coming down one eye. But Baz and Adrian from Handspring talk about the suffering state and that, like, you're in this kind of, I don't know, that there's some enjoyment to be had out of it. I can't quite remember. But essentially, you have to be really strong. You have to be really fit. You have to do loads of yoga to balance all your body out because you're constantly favouring one side. You always end up with one massive arm or like a hand that can't open. You know, I couldn't open the curtains when I was doing Joey because my trigger hands were so sort of locked. I did, like, in the morning, none of us could open any jars. Like, we were all just a bit stiffened up into the positions of your handles.
Wow. And I guess in the tech, when everything, of course, happens way more slowly, that must be even more painful. I mean, how's the tech work on the puppet side? We're sat tweaking, endlessly discussing what shade of blue to use, and you're standing with a 4 meter high dinosaur on your head.
Yeah, there's a lot of people shouting, like, in horse or in puppets, or, you know, people going, like, we are in here. Because you do forget.
The horse will be fine.
Yeah, they're fine. It's just standing there. Like, look at it. Just standing. And you're like, in order for that thing to stand up, someone is holding it up, you know, on their human muscle. But you just forget, like, even though I've been inside these horses while, like, they're bent over while someone's having a conversation, and you're like, hey, minute, they'll stop now. So I won't cause a fuss. You know, I'll just hold on for 1 second longer. And then eventually go, sorry, the little voice within. But it is, again, it's like you say, it's this sort of image of, oh, that's just a horse over there waiting.
So you just carry on talking about whatever we're doing. And of course, the tech is more than this waiting around for lighting, because obviously it's about how you get on stage, how you get off the stage, how you walk up the steps and all that kind of thing. And I guess having puppets in a show adds a big element to that technical rehearsal process.
Yeah, I mean, puppeteers are always like compromised visually. They very rarely have full vision, and running into flats is always a thing, you know, being able to make sure you can see edges of the stage. But yeah, there's also a lot of work that goes on in tech for puppeteers. Like puppeteers are huge geeks and love going over the fine details of how you can finesse this little thing. And so in a tech, when loads of time opens up, you know, they'll be squirreled away going, oh, actually, what we could do is I could do this here, and you could do something. A load of work.
Yeah, it happens. In about, I know, it's true. I think everyone squirrels as much as they can into those gaps as possible. Yeah. So what makes a good tech from your point of view? Let's say as a puppet director.
I suppose just having a really clear eye on the puppeteers, knowing where they are on stage. Like, lighting is a huge thing, because the first time we ran Joey's Night, which was a huge, huge sequence in Warhorse at the end of the show, and it was on a revolve that was revolving around, and we were running counter to revolve, and it's all very disorientating. And then we did it in tech with sort of which the lights on, and these tights that essentially was like Joey's skin suddenly became opaque, and we couldn't see out and couldn't orientate ourselves. And that was the first time I've got absolutely no idea where the front is or where the back, and we're running at full pelt wearing a big horse, you know, without being able to suddenly, like, it's like someone had just drawn the curtains. Mm. So I think knowing that, having those experiences in my mind, I'm just always super hot on safety, actually, in techs with puppeteers, making entrances, exits, floors, edges, where flats are. Like, I've run into flats and dislocated collarbones and things, so I haven't been able to see them, and, you know, with the sort of side lighting. It's all about being able to see.
No, it's crucial, because if you're not comfortable on the stage, because of just you don't know where the physical edges are, then a bit of your brain can't be thinking about performance. It's got to be thinking about everything else. So you need to sort of square all that away, don't you?
Often the field of vision is in when you're inside big puppets, it's directly below you. You get to see a bit of floor that's maybe, you know, half a foot square. And that's what you're orientating off. So like floor marks. And I think imagine sort of doing a show with a bucket on your head. That's what most puppeteering is like.
You were both sides of the footlights as performer and one of the creative team. Do you have a preference? Are you moving more towards one or the other now?
No, I'll do anything, Bruno. I'll do whatever anyone needs.
Does one inform the other? Do you enjoy doing both?
Yeah, definitely. And when I was pregnant, actually, I suddenly thought, I can't really puppeteer with a dog, you know, while I'm really pregnant, and sort of moved into more directing. But because I've always been a divisor and theatre maker, it didn't feel like a big leap. And actually, yeah, my head is always on what the performers are needing and are wanting. Like, because all those instincts are still in there. I'm still very, very attuned to sort of performer needs, which is sometimes a good thing, sometimes not a good thing, actually. Sometimes I think if I'd never performed and I was just directing, I might have a different take on some things. But it is very strong still, and it definitely helps with puppeteering, because I know the process that they need night after night, and body-wise, I know what people need. I try to remember that things are heavy and things are hard, and when things are heavy, it's weirdly emotional, and your tolerance levels really go down when you're carrying loads of weight, and the complicated relationships of very close puppeteering relationships, what they need, and yeah, I'd hope it helps.
I mean, so, hearing you talk about it, it sounds like it definitely must do. And how do you overcome differences in performers' physical movement skills, or in fact, physical skills generally? I imagine directing movement for a trained dancer is a very different thing from working with, shall we say, less athletic performers.
Yeah, for sure. And there's always a range, I suppose. And the sort of best advice I've ever had on that when I've conferred with other movement directors is to be working with people's, with the bodies that you have. You know, that's where the most interesting work is going to come from as well, in terms of people feeling like they can own their movement and they can own what they're delivering. And then it would always, for me, it's more interesting than a sort of blanket type of movement that you're putting on top of a body. So it's a similar thing of going, like, what's the puppet? What's the object? Like, meet the object, and then what does that object do?
Yeah.
Really, to sort of think into a body like that. And I love different bodies and different ages and different rhythms, you know, and so to sort of celebrate that feels good.
Mm.
I'd like to ask you a bit about your experience of puppeteering for film, if I may, just briefly, because this is the Making Theatre podcast. But it's interesting because it's clearly a transferable skill, and that's a major asset these days. You worked on some large films too, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, for example. I assumed that all of that was CGI, but there's still a demand for puppets in film, is that right? There's still a demand for classics like Yoda and Dark Crystal and all those things.
Yeah, big time. And more so at the moment, there's a trend that's swung back to puppets.
Ah, interesting. Because it's more convincing? Or
yeah, you can feel it. You can sense the playability within it. And I think there's a sort of smooth over that you get from the pure CGI that people are sort of kicking back against. We did some stuff on Gravity and Alfonso Cuarón had just been to Seawalls and he was like, that performance quality, I want that in the film. So we want it to feel like that. So we did puppeteer, essentially, Sandra Bullock and George Clooney on these sort of swings in space.
Right.
But, you know, then you've got your own timing. There's all the good stuff comes in. I did some stuff really recently with some animatronics with a lot of the guys who make the creatures for Star Wars and Jurassic Park and the big, you know, creature companies. And we were working with a Finnish director and we were doing sort of early test shots to see what would be a puppet maybe and what would be CGI or what would be an animatronic. More and more, she was like, yeah, and this one, we'll have a puppet. It's like, if ever it was going to be emotional or carry story or interact with another human, crucially, if it's got to interact with another human to get a good performance off the human, they want another human.
I'm sure it must be so hard for a performer to talk to a stick, you know, or two golf balls, whatever, a tennis ball on a string.
So just to clarify that, the puppets were so that the actors could interact with something physical in the space, is that right?
Yeah.
And they used that as a starting point for the CGI as well, presumably.
Quite often in film, you're doing a mixture of a human interaction thing, so like really playing a scene and being sort of CGI reference points. But it is puppets basically as placeholders for CGI, and there is a whole level of technicality that people who do loads of this stuff are really brilliant at, kind of running alongside a physical performance, you know, that they've got a bit of an eye on what the camera needs or what the CGI people are going to need. We did some quite early stuff on the Historic Materials, and it was like, oh, maybe they're just under a table, you know, just sort of trying to get rid of all the puppeteers. And then obviously they went completely the other way and were like, no, we've just got to have a puppeteer, a puppet, a full puppet, and let them play the scene. That was for people to be able to play off these puppets. And then they would have been completely CGI'd out, actually. But it is really interesting working with film directors who want that, because it's quite a new feeling, a new take on it.
That's really gives me great optimism for the future, though.
Me too.
Because that's a sort of injection of the human back into the process, right? I mean, there's so much talk about AI at the moment, and that, I mean, I would put money on the fact that it's going to do exactly the same thing. Is that the further we go down that route, the more people will start to realize that there's something missing.
Yeah.
And it's the human.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's the human interaction, because that is where it's interesting, isn't it? When you're in that space where there's action and reaction, and it could be anything. But somehow, if it's not a human, you just sense that it couldn't be anything. It's not infinite and anything's possible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, hey, I had a massive problem with the ABBA show that's, you know, basically watching a giant video of ABBA. Personally, I'd rather go and watch a tribute act because they're real. They're actually performing the music on that night in that particular way. So,
yeah.
And it's really comforting to hear that the film industry is using more real humans to operate puppets than just technology.
Lots of our Warhol's pals, they do that now full time.
Well, hits to humans and transferable skills.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah, it's positive, isn't it?
Yeah. Feels like a good point to move on to the quick fire round, our last little gallop to the finish line with a few short, sharp questions. If you're in charge, what single thing could be done to improve the work-life balance to theatre makers?
But quick questions.
I'll give you my quick answer. Ban all rehearsals on Saturdays or Sundays. That would be mine.
Yeah, pick up times, be able to pick up your kid from school, I don't know, every other day, or drop them off.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think our world does need to think about this a bit more than it does.
It is super hard for mothers returning to the artistic workplace. The arts could do, I think, could be a bit more muscular and robust about supporting returning mums to work, because it's the dropout for mums in the arts is huge.
Huge, yeah.
And well, like screamingly, yeah, what a shame. So
yeah, I agree.
Are you an early bird or a night owl?
Oh, I'm the middle. I'm a middling.
You're a lunchtime lark. There you go. That's
I've just started running, so the only time I could do that is at 6:30 in the morning. So in that respect, I'm early. My two children are early, but then I have to get everything done late. So, whew, you know.
All the owls right now. What's your favourite tool?
Ooh, a pencil. A good pencil. A lovely, clicky pencil.
Love it. What do you do to relax, Laura?
I cook. I listen to music. I dance in the kitchen and go running along the canal.
If you couldn't make theatre, what would you do?
I'd be a gardener. Yeah, hands down. I do garden alongside. I find it reassuringly finite, as opposed to theatre making, which can rumble on.
If you could have a rider like a rock star to get you through the tech, what would be on it?
Apples. Just a bog standard apple. Some friends that I work with, they had a rider that whenever they did a show, somebody from the theatre, whoever wanted to, had to make a mixtape, and it was the walk-in music. And I always thought that was brilliant.
That's great.
And postcards and stamp on, so that when they were touring, they could always write a postcard to their family. Well, that's nice.
That's really good.
Very sweet.
I'd nick those two.
Favourite part of the process?
Week one, I think, when you're being very fast and you're going with big, quick, sweeping ideas, and you're being your kind of bravest. Or you've got all your energy, or R&D week when it's all up in the air and you're just doing sort of lunacy ideas and real sort of dream space ideas that, you know, that are audacious.
So your favourite bit's the beginning?
I think so. Yeah, I like the beginning. Halfway through, I have a crisis of confidence that all of the ideas I started with aren't good enough. And that's always a low. And then week three, I get back into them again. And then I quite enjoy tidying everything up at the end. But, you know, that's just, that's tootling. It's the,
brilliant.
It's the ideas section, the ideas factory. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a dream project?
Oh, yeah. I mean, lots of them. I'd love to make something of my own with some dear friends that I've met along the way who are brilliant, you know, brilliant devisors with great minds, great senses of humour. I'd love to make it in the Lofoten Islands in Norway, where they have a brilliant creation space for puppet.
What specific?
Yeah, yeah. And it's stunning, like this beautiful, yeah.
That's
like,
amazing,
you know,
there.
It looks like the Caribbean, but with snow. Yeah. So yeah, I need to do that next.
We're going to end on a very serious note, I'm afraid. This is a very important question we ask everybody. Pudding or cheese?
Or cheese, hands down cheese.
Every time. We're in strong agreement with cheese, definitely.
Yeah, cheese. I'd share someone's pudding, but I'd focus on the cheese.
It's a good tactic, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want a pudding. Can I have some of yours?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe just an extra spoon.
Laura, thank you so much. I think it's time we nip to the virtual Making Theatre podcast bar. It's James's round. What can he get you?
Oh, I'll have a nice half of craft lager. Why not?
Very good. Laura, thank you. You're brilliant. It's so good hearing you talk about what you do. It's just, yeah, fantastic.
Well, what a ramble. I hope it makes sense in some form or another.
I think that was great. The most fun we've had is when you talk to somebody who does something that's as far removed from what we do as it gets. It's just great to hear all those insights. That's what makes it really interesting.
And your enthusiasm for it. I can see it obviously in your face too, but you can hear your voice light up when you're talking about it, which is just brilliant.
It's now still enthusiastic after all these years, isn't it? You go, yeah, I do still.
You really are. You convinced us anyway.
The Making Theatre podcast is compiled, produced and edited by Bruno Poet and myself, James Farncombe. As ever, if you have any questions, comments, or even ideas for future episodes, you can contact us on Instagram or Twitter at MakingTheatreFM, or if you prefer, by email on MakingTheatrePodcast@gmail.com. We are doing this for fun, and also hopefully to contribute to a broader awareness of everyone's role in the industry. So we do all the hard work, all you have to do is spread the word and take a moment to leave us a glowing review on your favourite podcast platform. Seems like a pretty good deal to me, and we'd be very grateful. Until next time, thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.